Today's episode of Hollywood How Did You Get Here is brought to you by G Technologies, a leading storage solution brand for the entertainment industry. Stay tuned for a special offer from G Technology later on in the show. I'd also like to give a special thanks to our lighting sponsor, LEDGO Technologies, for supporting our show. On today's episode, we're going to take a look at the unique path IMAX cinematographer James Nias, ASC, has taken from his early days at Brooks Institute to what it's like to circle the world in his latest film. All right, welcome to Hollywood. How did you get here? I'm here with James Nias, and today we're going to talk about James's career. So, James, welcome.
Hi, Tim. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm here at home talking to you, so it's a good thing.
Yeah.
All right. So the show is called Hollywood. How did you get here? And that's where we're going to start. Tell me a little bit about why you wanted to become a cinematographer. Did you pick up your first camera at the age of three, or how did this all kind of transpire?
How did I get here? Left turn at Albuquerque, I guess. I don't know. There's only a certain number of the audience that will actually get that reference, but I started out as in Arkansas, where I grew up, sort of picked up my dad's camera and started taking pictures when I was just a kid. And it just sort of stuck. So all through high school, I was, you know, the yearbook photographer, which was great because all the cheerleaders in the palm of my hand, because they all wanted their picture in the yearbook. Just stuck with it. Decided to go to photography school. I went to Brooks Institute of Photography in Santa Barbara, which is sort of a long story, but I think we have some time.
Yeah.
The reason I went there was at that time there were really only two major schools kind of around, and that was Rochester Institute, which churned out Kodak technicians, and Brooks was the sort of art school. Being from Arkansas and having never seen an ocean before, and seen snow, I decided I'd go see the ocean in Santa Barbara. And that's how I picked Brooks. I wanted to learn how to dive, which I don't know where I got that from growing up in Arkansas. But part of my Brooks education was I took two underwater photography classes. And enjoyed it. I became an instructor. I taught scuba as a part-time job. And the company who actually taught the underwater class for Brooks ended up hiring me when I got out of school and to, you know, take underwater pictures. And I produced an oil spill response manual video. You know, we did a lot of oil field work. About 2 months after I started there, this Canadian showed up with this funny looking big camera and wanted to shoot underwater with it. And it turned out it was Graham Ferguson, who was one of the co-founders of IMAX. Yeah. And we helped him. All they had was a splash housing, which was made out of fiberglass, and it kept leaking and doing bad things. We finally ended up building a new housing and getting the film shot. But Graham wanted to occasionally, as the director, wanted to get in the water and see what we were shooting. So I taught him how to not kill himself with scuba in a, you know, private class in a couple of days. And
so you're shooting IMAX back in school?
I was out of school.
Out of school. But stayed in Brooks. Stayed at Brooks.
Stayed in Santa Barbara.
Santa Barbara. I interviewed at Brooks and they said no. I flew all the way out from Maine to California. I went through an interview, looked at this school, which was paradise, the school itself. Unfortunately, Brooks isn't around anymore, but that school was just, the campus and everything on it was just spectacular.
And there was nothing like that Montecito campus up on the hill.
Yep.
Oh man.
Oh, I toured that thing and won it in the worst way, came out, did the interview, and got a no letter.
So, oh no.
Yep. And that's why I'm on this side of the podcast and you're on that side of the podcast.
I guess.
But I loved it. And, you know, but years later, actually, when Brooks was still there and I'd already moved into my career with Canon, the manufacturer, and they were a big supporter of this school, I got invited up to teach some classes there. and I felt vindicated. So not good enough to be a student, but I could teach. So, I loved that school. I really did. So
it was sad after 70 years to see it go. And I know they had a lot of issues at the end there with the corporation that bought them out.
Yeah.
But I'm still in touch with Ernest Brooks Jr. Through Facebook. So we converse occasionally, and it's a great, there's a lot of great alumni out there, and it was a fun school. I miss it. I miss the school. I it's one of those things I'd go back and redo if I had the chance. It's my days at Brooks.
Yeah. And I'm sorry I didn't get to do that. All right. So back to shooting IMAX. So your first IMAX shoots are like months after school.
Yeah. I graduated in September, and I think we were shooting in November, by the middle of November. Of course, I wasn't shooting. It was the guy that owned the company was the cinematographer. I just the still guy. And but they took me along on the shoot to shoot, underwater behind the scenes stuff. They wanted me to keep Graham alive if he went in the water to dive. So I was kind of there to be his wingman. Be an underwater grip and shark bait as necessary. it was great. We spent 4 or 5 weeks out, on the Channel Islands and off Santa Barbara on this old boat called the Emerald. And it had been a logging boat on Lake Tahoe, and they took it apart and they brought it down to California, down to Santa Barbara, and turned it into a dive boat. But it was a great time. It's one of those times in your life that you just know it won't ever repeat. It was so special. Everything that they wanted to shoot seemed like it showed up. We wanted to get whales, we wanted to get squid mating, we wanted to get seals, all this stuff. We just kind of drove out there and everything appeared. Which was lucky because they had a April release date, hard release date in the San Diego Reuben Fleet Space Theater. So we had to get the housing belt and then get in the water and shoot the film, and all under a very, very tight schedule. That's what excited me about motion picture. And it was that experience with IMAX and that camera. And they had an assistant by the name of April Townsend. April was one of these guys. He would dig into the camera every night and clean everything, make sure it's all perfect. One of the most anal guys you ever run into, the perfect assistant. Mm-hmm. And, I thought, wow, that's really cool. I want to do that.
Yeah, that was my favorite part of the whole, is always playing with the tweaking with the toys. And I love to build a rig. You can shoot all you want, but nothing like prep for me to get excited to make it all work. You stayed in IMAX for most of your career.
Yes.
And shooting underwater and in space. At some point we could talk about maybe something you shot where you could breathe the air. Was it that early experience with IMAX that kind of focused you towards IMAX, or did you sort of fall backwards into that? Or
it was that experience with the giant screen. I mean, there's the classic IMAX theater that with, a 97 by 117 foot screen is pretty amazing to see. And to see your image on that screen is pretty profound. So it did. It just grabbed me, and I couldn't get enough of learning. I'd been a still guy. I majored in industrial scientific photography, as well as color technology, and then my minor in underwater. So I was kind of the technical guy still wise. But I mean, when I saw it, got in with IMAX and saw that, I started trying to learn, just self taught everything I could about making films, and the bug bit, and the rest is history.
A lot of people were self-taught back in those days, because it was sort of, everybody was building the airplane while we already were in the air on a lot of those things. And we did that again a few generations later with digital, but you're also teaching. You've taught full-time, you've taught part-time, in between all the gigs.
Right.
Where does film school fit in these days in terms of, is it one of those things where the industry has shifted such a way that without film school, there's no way in?
I don't know. I don't know. There's, I mean, it, you know, with Canon's 5D and the whole democratization of filmmaking in the digital age, that, you know, put a lot of people out there on YouTube and all these other platforms that we can put stuff out on. I don't know that film school is that relative anymore, apart from probably one of the most important things that you can get is contacts, is people in the business. You know, you look at the guys from USC, Caleb Deschanel and I forget what they call themselves. There was a whole pack of filmmakers that came out of USC about that time. You know, they helped each other out. They worked together and I think it's the contacts that will get you more places than all the technical knowledge you have.
So you and I both lived through the democratization period, the 5Ds, the, you know, the SLRs, now the Black Magics, and all the cameras that are in the very affordable range for storytellers. And I've seen some great stuff. I mean, especially, you know, in my early days, because I was very much involved in the 5D. And I saw some great films. I saw some great stuff. I saw some horrible stuff. And I think the difference to me was that film school still teaches storytelling. And I think that's something that, you know, maybe you don't need the days of all the labs and all the, but the storytelling, you know, and maybe you can be this natural when it comes to lighting and you can be this savant when it comes to the technology. But I think storytelling is something, you know, maybe that doesn't mean, I don't know what that works out to be. Do you really need to, you know, I've got a kid in college who's already got his degree in audio engineering, who was going to hang boom poles on TV shows and got through his first show and said, hell, that's just like 18 hours a day. I'm done. And now he's back in school again. Because it wasn't everything, you know. Look, we both know this is not everything everybody else thinks it is. It's a hell of a lot of work and it's not easy to do. And the saddest part about it is that you can work just as hard on a bad movie as you can a good movie. And you sit in the theater when it's done and go, man, oh man, look what we did. Or man, look what we did. So, but the storytelling is the thing I think that, you know, I mean, if you're a young cinematographer and you're ready to start telling stories, make sure you know how to tell a story or partner up with somebody who does. You know, if you're the camera guy and the lighting guy and that's what you do the best, then do that. But find a storyteller. Find a story. If you can't look at a script and realize if it's good or not, maybe you need, you know.
Shouldn't be doing it. Yeah.
Shouldn't be doing it or should be looking to fill that void. So, all right. So IMAX has been a big deal. And you're sort of known as the IMAX in space guy. If a camera has left this orbit, you've probably touched it.
Maybe most 95% of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that by reputation or is that by your desire? Is it just, hey, look, we're going to do this. We call James, or is it, this is what I really love doing, those kind of films?
It was desire. I had always been in interested in the space program. And, when Graham, started talking about flying things in space, I'm going like, okay, call me, you know? And, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed shooting the launches. It combined the artistic portion of cinematography with a whole really technical aspect of setting up launch remotes. You've been out on a shoot with me to see how remotes are set up. It was really got to me. And then when I got started training the astronauts to shoot in space, that was a dream come true for me, to be able to be that close with the space program. So, you know, as a kid, I grew up in the 60s. I watched the Apollo guys land on the moon. Little did I know then that Michael Collins would be the reason that I would be shooting in films in space. You know, he's the one that told Graham to, you know, you guys got to fly this camera in space. It's the only way that'll show the world what I saw and what I felt in space. And it was that impetus that put Graham and IMAX on the track to fly the camera. So
IMAX is involved, though. I mean, we're talking about the times when we were kids, and IMAX then was space museums or museums. It wasn't the local theater. IMAX now is associated with a big screen and Chris Nolan and
Cineplex.
Yeah, Cineplex stuff. How does that change the way you approach it? Is there a difference between shooting IMAX for Batman or for Inception or any of the big IMAX films? I don't even know, not Inception, but I guess what I'm saying is a commercial film versus a science-based film. Is it approached differently in IMAX, or is it the same sort of experience?
It's definitely approached differently. With IMAX films, you don't have that time to really develop characters. For institutional films, they were usually limited to like 45 minutes because they wouldn't be able to turn them around once an hour for school kids during the school year, because that was a big source of revenue for them. With the feature films, you're cutting quicker, you're letting the dialogue a lot of times drive the visual rather than the other way around. But Nolan definitely has taken it to seriously. His new film Tenet, I think they shot 850,000 feet of IMAX film for that. But it's the Cineplex theaters. It's the smaller digital theaters in IMAX that really have saved the company, because without that continued growth, although it's in a different direction, IMAX I think would have hit a wall, early 2000, something like that, where they were saturating the market. And especially with, if they could have held out and had a good, quickly a good replacement for film, like now we've got a 4K laser system that looks great. If we could have had that 4K laser system in 2000, I think all the institutional film theaters would have taken off. But the problem with it was lots and lots of costs involved with that print. It cost you $45,000-$50,000 for a print. Whereas now you get a $250 hard drive and there you go. So I think the digital transition kind of screwed IMAX for the institutional theaters, but it also helped them into Cineplex, the AMCs and Cineon.
Well, was there a sense that you couldn't do IMAX without film? That you really couldn't get an IMAX experience digitally? That it had to be, I mean, for a little while?
Well, it still is. Still digital won't quite cut it when it comes to the big, wide, detailed shots that are the IMAX signature in the grand theaters. You just can't get that with an 8K sensor. If we're looking at 18 by 12K for an IMAX frame, and all that tremendous bit depth, so it's not there. I mean, all that tiny little noise that's there, tiny little information, is what makes you forget that you're watching a movie. It's more like you're actually there. That's the big difference. But for theatrical release, like the Arri 65, those cameras are good. But again, you're dealing with an aspect ratio that is much, shorter and wider rather than taller and big.
We're going to talk a little bit in the next section about craft, but there's a lot of buzz right now about the new Reds and the new Canons in terms of raw recordings and bigger sensors. Where do you if we really wanted to take that IMAX experience that we had when we were kids and do it electronically instead of with film? We're nowhere near there yet, you're saying?
For 80, we're 85% there. But the thing about it is there's the IMAX wow shots that just don't work as well in digital. And if you plan your show so that you're going to shoot those in film, mm-hmm. and shoot everything else digital, that's really the best right now to be able to do that.
Yeah, there was. Well, if we go back to one of the first things you and I were on the Hubble, we were shooting HDV tape, 25 megabits, 420, 8-bit compression. Sorry if that got a little too tweaky there, but that the idea that that even made it to a screen is astounding.
Yeah, it looks pretty good, but again, you're shooting real close-up stuff that doesn't have a lot of detail to deal with in.
But that particular film, we mixed that with traditional IMAX film, so you really could sit in the theater and go, "I see the difference." I don't know if it actually, it was a stunning film, and I don't know if the audience cares like we care. But yeah, you could really see the difference.
Oh yeah, so. Yeah. And so some of the shots are better than others. It's like I said, some things works and some things don't. And the better as the technology improved over the past 10 or 12 years, the number of shots you can do for the big screen with a digital camera has grown. Uh-huh. I did a film about the Chesapeake 2 years ago, and we shot it all with Red 8K. And, it's not things, some of the things worked really well and some of the things were not so great, but,
I have found in my experience, and I can say this, that there's never really been one tool for every job. And I've seen them all perform well in the right environment. But what I did learn working with you for all those years was that there were things like size and weight that are sort of this. Well, and what did an original IMAX camera weigh?
The first one that I dealt with back in 1976 was in that neighborhood of 90 pounds with a 3-minute film load. So they weren't light. They weren't portable particularly, No.
And film weighed a small.
The film for 3 minutes of footage, it was 10 pounds. So the film weighed more than digital cameras do now.
Right. I think there's a something to be said creatively for being able to let the cinematographer and the director think about what they can shoot to tell their story without the physical limitations that they had with IMAX. I mean, didn't you go up Mount Everest with an IMAX camera?
I didn't, but yeah, they sent an IMAX camera up Mount Everest. They did a very aggressive weight loss program with it, redid all the electronics, the motor. They only shot 500-foot loads, so they cut the weight of the film down. I think they only took 1,500 feet to the top of the mountain, so 15 pounds of film. We took it to the Titanic. It went to the Titanic. It's been in space, been the top of Mount Everest.
Everywhere there's no air or it's really thin, one or the other.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to jump a little bit and talk about the newest project. It's not out yet. Trailers are starting to show up on the internet that you did with Terry Virts and Every Camera Under the Sun, from what I recall.
Every Camera Under the Sun. I mean, if you.
But it was an environment where you could breathe the air anyway, as long as your head wasn't out the window. Okay, so go ahead and set up the film.
Okay. Last summer, just as CineGear was ending in early June, Terry was in LA for CineGear, and he said, "Well, I've got a guy who wants to shoot a film about a world record attempt flying around the poles."
I want to qualify real quick. Tell everybody who Terry is, because you and I know him, but we better.
Terry Virts. Terry is an astronaut, former astronaut. He flew once on Space Shuttle, and then he did an extended mission aboard the space station, at which time he was really our primary cinematographer for A Beautiful Planet. So he did a lot of the shooting for our last space film, IMAX space film. So I've sort of kept up with him, and we've done a few projects here and there. And this One More Orbit was, he's going to do one more orbit of the Earth, but he's going to go around the poles this time and going to do it at much lower altitude in a business jet. So from the very first of June to July 7th or 8th, I forget exactly which day it was, maybe in July 8th, we put the whole program together to film this world record attempt in a Gulfstream G650ER extended range out of Qatar, Doha, Qatar. So yeah, and Qatar Airways helped us out. They had crews around the world. We had film crews around the world. So it was quite, I forget how many cameras we used, but there were a lot of them.
Yeah, there was a, yes. And you landed all over the world, had to recheck. And how many hours was the, don't tell anybody if he set the record or not. Let's wait for the film to come out. But how many hours did you shoot?
Hours of footage? Oh, gosh.
Well, I mean, from the time, it's basically one, it's kind of a one-take film in a weird way.
They had, oh, it was a one-take film. They had, they had to make the trip in under 48 hours. Let's put it that way. And to set the record. And that includes stopping. They stopped in Nur-Sultan, Kazakhstan, after crossing the North Pole. And they flew from there to Port Louis, Mauritius, for a refuel stop, which was the shortest leg. And then they flew from Mauritius to Punta Arenas, Chile, over the South Pole, which was actually their longest and dangerous leg. And then from Punta Arenas back to the Kennedy Space Center where they started. And it was 2 days. It was, you know, they left and I was supposed to go on the flight. The Monday that we flew the Gulfstream into KSC, they came to me after we landed and said, you have to fly. You have to go with us to shoot this thing because we're overloaded. We know we're not going to be able to get the footage we need. So I spent that night getting ready to be gone for 2 days on a round the world tour. Early that next morning, they're weighing everything to get on the airplane. And it comes my time to get weighed in, and they only have 65 pounds of payload left. So rather than just send my head, I had to stay on the ground. They had talked about flying me to trying to go to Punta Arenas, and they did the math, and the airplane would get there and leave before I would be able to get there flying commercial. So I ended up staying here in Florida and catching both ends of the flight. And we had a crew in Nur-Sultan and one in Mauritius and one in Punta Arenas.
Let's talk about the crew for a second, because you're an ASC cinematographer, American Society of Cinematographers, which means you're one of the best of the best, or you don't get in there. And you managed to wrangle some pretty good cinematographers to work for you on this one. who'd you get?
I called my friend Richard Crudo. Yep. Up, and because he's a space geek and he'll do anything to come to the Space Center down here. He had been with us when we filmed the launch for you guys and for Beautiful Planet. So he came in, and then I needed somebody to go to Punta Arenas that I could really trust, because I knew that was going to be the most challenging aspect, you know, the most challenging landing, because it's going to be at night, it's cold, it's the middle of winter. They may or may not make it into that airport. So I asked Bill Bennett, ASC, to go down there, because he's a pilot. Mm-hmm. And so he understands it completely. And I could just say, okay, go there and do it. And I don't have to tell him anything. So he went down there. We had, Dan Green, who went to Nur-Sultan, and, Nick, why can't I come up with Nick's last name? He's going to shoot me. A crew of very, very good shooters, but in all, we had three ASC members on this film, which was to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. And everybody was buzzing about it. Plus everybody else wanted on the film. It was this huge,
yeah.
I wanted on the film, actually. You know, anything, charge the batteries. So I felt, so if you ever do this again, I, you know, I'm available.
It was interesting. One of the more interesting aspects was that they live streamed as much of it as they can,
right,
for almost the entire flight. So that's actually took up the person who was going to do the filming. That's why they wanted me to go along, because she got so deep into that live stream that she wasn't going to have Janneke Melkens wasn't going to have time to really shoot anything. But they live streamed it. So we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 small cameras feeding the live stream that she was able to switch through an Odyssey Apollo system. We had a couple of cameras looking out, shooting time lapses out a couple of the windows. I think in all on board the airplane, we had 8, 9 cameras. Mm-hmm. And then each crew, each remote crew, the Kazakhstan, Mauritius, and Chile, they had at least 4 cameras each. And then we had 5 or 6 crews here at KSC covering. I had a guy on top of the vehicle assembly building to shoot landings and takeoffs, and guys in the tower to shoot that, and just all over the place to cover this, because it was a one take film. That's been my life, though. Space is one take.
Yeah. What's the runtime on the film when it comes out? Do you know yet?
It's just over an hour. I want to say an hour and 15.
So you shot 48 hours of footage and edited it down to 60 minutes.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing.
And it is running. It's playing on Qatar Airways. They provided the jet and the crews. So they wanted to play it on their in-flight entertainment system. So it's available there, but I'm not sure where it's going to be released as yet.
Yeah, it's got to show up somewhere. I mean, it really does. Any chance it'll ever get out into anything big? I mean, I know it was like a big screen type of thing. I don't
think so. Possibly. Mm-hmm. If it takes off,
Well, when the world gets back to normal, we'll fall.
Gets back to normal, who knows what'll happen?
Yeah, yeah. We'll rent a theater and bring some people in or something. All right. So I'm going to ask you one more question before we move on to the next section of the show. If you could tell somebody to watch one of your films, just one, somebody who's never seen anything you've ever shot, which film do you recommend?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that A Beautiful Planet would probably be the one I would want most people to see. It's a toss-up between that and the previous Earth film from space, Blue Planet. Matter of fact, I have my Blue Planet poster right behind me. So it would either be Blue Planet or A Beautiful Planet, just because of the message the films transmit. They want, you know, you want to look at the Earth from a different point of view to get that reality of we are a spaceship here, and there's nobody flying up supplies to us if we screw it up here.
So for those that didn't see Beautiful Planet, but I did because I got to work on that one. So good choice.
I did.
It was shot entirely, almost entirely on the International Space Station over the course of a year.
Yeah, more than a year.
All shot digitally. I don't think there's any. Is there any IMAX film in Beautiful Planet? Is there any actual film?
I think there are 3 shots that were stock footage from previous. The first one is the shot of Florida as the film opens. That's film.
Right,
I think
right.
a shot of the Hawaiian Islands, mm-hmm. And then there's an effect shot of. We show what would happen if we lost our atmosphere and you know, Lake Superior drains and turns into Mars, basically. So, but
yeah,
that's interesting. That was that shot was the very first from the very first IMAX film and was the very first aerial shot in IMAX.
Well, I mean, the film itself makes a huge statement about global warming and what's going on this planet right now. And from a perspective that no one else could see. And when you step away from a problem like that, literally fly away and then look back at it, it's impossible to deny. It really is. So, it was an important film. And it was a fascinating film to work on. It wasn't without its challenges.
And, many challenges.
And it lasted, I don't know, we probably from concept to finish, it was probably a 2-year project.
I started doing, because we had to shoot it all digital. I started doing tests, camera tests in 2012. Wow. When did the C300 come out? It was 2012.
The original 300. Yeah, 2012. That project was HD. Was it HD?
4K.
4K.
4K. I knew that the C500 was coming down.
That's right. We went 500. Right.
Yeah. We shot 500.
Yeah. So it would have been about then. Yeah. It'd be so much easier now. Let's do it again. All right. Last question. Then we go. If you're a teacher, you have students. If they could only watch one film, not yours, but one film.
Oh, God.
It doesn't have to be your favorite film. It doesn't have to be a blockbuster. It just has to be a film that you think everybody should see this if you're going to be in this business.
Oh, there's too many of them.
All right. I won't hold you to saying there's only one, but which one jumps into your...
Citizen Kane comes into mind right off the top just because of the cinematography. I love the cinematography in that film. But then there's 2001 and, you know, the vision, Kubrick's visual storytelling in that, you know, but all sorts of them there. It just, you can't narrow it down. If you're going to be a serious filmmaker.
I haven't asked this question on the show yet. So I don't know, maybe we'll edit it. But if you could pick one out of the last 5 years,
the scary thing is nothing really pops to mind out of the last 5 years.
Yeah, that's kind of why I'm asking. I wonder if there's, like you mentioned Richard Crudo earlier. He went with Godfather, which is so Richard. But yes, and it is a film that stands out. But what stands out for the current generation of filmmakers?
That's more than 5 years though. So
let's go 10. I mean, there's always the Deakins work. Pretty much anything that he put his name to is a classic kind of film that might be looked back on in 20 years, the way you're looking back on Kubrick. I mean, he could be that way. I think that the next generation looks back on Rachel Morrison's work and says, this is not ordinary. This is not just storytelling. This is next level stuff. To me, she's done huge things, including a film called Mudbound, which was commercially. And I was floored with that film.
I would probably pick up Mudbound now that you mention it.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of one of those films that I tell everybody that they should see if they really want to see what talented cinematographers can do. And this is tough to say because we both have a lot of friends in this that do this. I don't want to not recommend somebody else's film, but that one had a huge effect on me. I really thought it was a major visual stunning film. So I think that goes there. But I guess my point is everybody goes to some sort of a classic. Maybe we even go to films that made an impression on us as opposed, Citizen Kane was pre-me, but we all saw 2001. I'm just wondering what's next. I think the world is a little bit, I know because we both have kids, they grew up in a different world. They're watching movies on iPhones and iPads and they're playing video games and the whole way that they take in images is so completely different.
Different.
That it's very hard to understand what classic storytelling is going to be like visually 10 years from now because the audience has changed. The flavors have changed. The ingredients have changed. There are different things. Like, have you watched anything on the Quibi network yet?
I have not. I've heard the interesting tales about post for it because they want you to be able to turn it in.
Right, because they're definitely.
I'm like, hey.
Right. They're sort of acknowledging the way people are watching images these days, or why they're taking in their entertainment. They're also doing it in 10-minute bites, quick bites. You know, the quick bite thing didn't throw me that much because we've been watching TV for years. And every 12 minutes, there's a commercial. But story arcs are different. And I don't know. And there's some stuff on there that I really liked. I watched a couple of things. Look, right now, we're all, you know, it's, we haven't really dated this show, but we're all in the middle of 2020. So we're all sucking up every piece of entertainment we can get just to pass the time. And I've watched quite a bit of it. And some I like, some I don't like, which is probably true of every media. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I just keep watching and thinking, is this what my, if I ever have them, grandkids are going to be looking back on? Is somebody doing what I do 30 years from now going to interview a cinematographer that just graduated from high school today or this season and say, what film did you watch? And they'll go, well, I saw this 10-minute thing on Quibi that really pushed me over the top, and I knew I had to get into the movie business.
Right.
You know, I mean, it just doesn't feel the same. Going into a big theater with the lights going down and sucking that all in and watching Citizen Kane, you know, it just...
That's I think, the difference is that setup. You know, you whip the phone, the iPhone out, and you watch something, whatever. But when you go in and you're expecting something, and I miss the curtains drawing back. That's why I always love going to see a film at the Academy in Hollywood. Is that red curtain drawing back, and man, you know, there's something.
Yeah, there's a difference in inspiration that just, you know, it's more inspirational. It's more, especially if you love films, and you know, I'm assuming the listeners to this podcast are film lovers.
Hopefully, they're film lovers. Yeah,
because this is not a cooking show. So
it's not a cooking show. I can't cook. Yeah,
it's about film lovers. Yeah. So, all right. Well, we're going to need to take a quick break here. And then we will come back and we'll talk about the craft of filmmaking. We'll get a little more geeky and into things that you like and don't like technically. So, all right. So we'll be right back. Hang on for a minute. This week's episode of Hollywood, How Did You Get Here? Is brought to you by G Technology. Since their inception in 2004, G Technology has offered affordable, reliable, high-performance hard drives. This week, in collaboration with G Technology, we're offering listeners of this podcast 10% off G Technology drives when you shop at filmtools.com. All you have to do is enter code Hollywood when you purchase a G Technology drive on filmtools.com. That's HOLLYWOOD to get 10% off G Technology drives from Film Tools. So if you're in the market for some new storage, make sure to head over to Film Tools and use code Hollywood at checkout to get 10% off your next G Technology drive purchase. And now back to the show. And we are back. This is the section where we get to talk about some of the geeky stuff. This is called Craft, the craft of filmmaking and what's available to you. Draw some comparisons between the cameras you grew up with and the cameras you have access to today. Are they really better or are they just different?
Well, I had a very, very broad selection of cameras that I grew up with. I started out with an old box Brownie that my dad had left to me, and moved from there to a Instamatic. I had Yashica twin lens, Yashica D twin lens, 120 film camera. I had a Miranda 35mm. Still camera. I still have the Mamiya RB67, which I found interesting because it's basically the same format as an IMAX frame. I got that camera when I was in high school and shot years and years with it. Film was film. You know, some cameras just made it easier to deal with. Everybody says, well, I want to learn how to take pictures. Well, learn how to take pictures with film, and then you don't have to worry about anything else down the road.
Yeah, there was a discipline to film that was related to the price. You know, I've lost that discipline. Just look at my iPhone pictures. You know, either that discipline is gone. But if I had shot that many exposures of any single thing back when I was in high school or after that,
I couldn't afford to.
Just, you know, when I was a kid, I was in the school I was in, one of my camera teachers was a sports photographer for the Boston Celtics, whose name escapes me. But he would take some of his students and he would let us go shoot at the Celtics games. But one of the ways you got in the car with him to head down to Boston to shoot was you had to shoot an uncut roll. You know, we had the large backs, you'd get like 200 exposures in a roll, and he would send us out to the freeway and you would shoot moving cars going past you. And then you would have to deliver him an uncut negative of, I think, 8 or 10 images that were all in focus without one being out of focus in between. And when you could get that uncut negative, he was like, well, you can come down. Basically, he ended up, you know, reloading his cameras for him, but he still had to pass the test. But yeah, that was quite the thing to get that uncut negative. And, you know, I'd go back and I'd develop them in my attic and then I'd put them all up and then I'd make 10 prints and send it over and say, look, I got 10 in a row of cars doing 60 miles an hour. But that was pre-autofocus, pre-everything. And that was his one test. And, you know, it was, I still think about that when I take a still image. I still think, how do I make this one be the one? Except with my iPhone, for some reason, I just keep hitting buttons. So anyway, so out of the gear that you've worked with over the years, what was sort of the first piece of new technology where you thought, okay, I have to approach this differently? Or what can I do? Was it when we went digital? Was it when we went to tape? What was, you know, I mean, we worked, how about we did HDV?
Yeah, I worked, I'm like many cinematographers, I worked television news as part of my career. I actually went from IMAX to television news. I found out really quickly it was shot completely differently. And you approached it. It was back in the days of 3/4-inch tape decks and, you know, 50 pounds on this shoulder and 40 pounds on that shoulder and, you know, hope your back holds out. But when you shoot, 4 or 5 stories in a day and then have to come back in and edit those stories, for a deadline at 6 o'clock, you learn quickly, to adjust what you shoot. A lot of times you would just try to edit in camera. It might not be frame to frame edit, but especially not with 3/4-inch tape, but, you would get your shots in a row you'd save that time from having to wind back and forth. So a lot of geeky technical stuff involved with that. But it got me understanding what worked for editing and then what actually worked for interviews and, you know, run and gun stuff, and which applied to lots of stuff down the road for me. So just being able to hop in and get a shot and get out. I'm rambling right now.
Well, you're talking about editing and that's what they're going to do. So
I'm editing a piece right now, so I'm not an editor.
So, we spent a lot of time on ice. Let's stay there for a minute. So, on not Beautiful Planet, on Hubble, you went with HDV cameras.
Right. With Hubble, this was post Columbia. And what NASA had done is said, okay, we're not flying any more shuttle missions anyplace else in orbit unless it's the same orbit as the International Space Station, unless we're going to the space station. Hubble wasn't in that orbit. So they said, no, we're not going to do this mission. And then there was so much pressure from Congress to do the mission that they finally said, okay, but we have to have all these safety precautions. They even had a second shuttle ready to launch on demand, launch on need, to come rescue the crew of Atlanta should something befall it, as did Columbia. So there wasn't a lot of room in the crew compartment for extras, and there sure wasn't any room for IMAX camera and IMAX film. So we had to go with a smaller solution, a digital solution. And again, we tested and came up with the Canon G1 HDV to shoot that, which we justified it that there is, you're in two different environments. You're either in the cargo bay with the real IMAX camera and the Hubble telescope, and that's going to be awesome. But then you're in the really cramped crew compartment up close and personal with that HDV camera. And the two sets were different enough that we thought we could get away with having two different distinct looks from cargo bay outside to inside. What really showed us on that was that because of the camera being quiet, an IMAX camera is like an angry sewing machine. Because of the HDV being quiet, we could record really good intimate sound in sync. We could run much longer. Mike Massimino, one of the astronauts, took the camera around and shot man on the street in space interviews with all of his crewmates. And we got to know them much better on a personal basis, which we'd never been able to do with an IMAX camera in the past. So what we lost in quality, we picked up 100 times over in storytelling value. So it was a plus.
What would you use today if you were going to redo it?
If I were going to do that, I would use probably something like the new C500, the Mark II, 4K with, you know, raw capabilities.
Yeah, good camera.
I ultimately like uncompressed stuff for IMAX, which is why we flew the 500 and the Codex recorder on Beautiful Planet. But I think I haven't yet to test the 500 Mark II to see how it goes up to the big screen. But I'm got good feelings about it.
I have. It looks great. definitely give that one a shot. The in-camera RAW is pretty spectacular, so it's quite the camera. And the stabilization always impressed me as well, so in-camera stabilization. When I pick up a new camera, whether it's a Canon from my alma mater or it's a new company, I always start thinking about things that we've already done, things that have already been shot, and think how this would have changed it. Because if I pick up a camera that doesn't change what I would have done in the past, then there was no point to picking up a new camera. And you definitely see that. There are some features you think, you know what, this would have made my life easier, would have made for storytelling to be better, or I would have gotten that thing that I couldn't have gotten that I wanted to get. So, I mean, the camera has to evolve.
That's what happened with A Beautiful Planet. Because we'd had so much luck with the G1 on Hubble, we started with Canon, the C300 testing in 2012 for A Beautiful Planet. Again, it was driven by NASA not having a space shuttle to bring film back from orbit, so we had to bring everything down via broadband, basically. We tested a lot of cameras over 2012, 2013, 2014. And came up with the C500 and the Codex onboard S recorder, but that combination gave us the ability to have a high ISO in orbit, which was enabled us to shoot things like city lights and aurora and stars, which we never ever would have gotten with film. Mm-hmm. So it enabled another storytelling point, because when you look at the planet from space in the daytime, you can't tell there's people down here. But when you look at it at night, you see the city lights. Mm-hmm. You see where the population centers are. You see where there's no population. You see where there's a border occasionally, very distinct border between Pakistan and India, a very distinct border between North and South Korea. You don't see that in the daytime. So it enabled us another to have another storytelling tool that we wouldn't have had with film. So it really made possible A Beautiful Planet to have that digital capture. And again, being able to shoot and not worry about reloading and 10 pounds per 3 minutes of film and noise. It made it work.
I got to say, out of all the films that I've had a chance to stick my finger into, Beautiful Planet's one I'm really proud of.
Thank you.
It was really quite the experience to watch it, to shoot it was fun, to, you know, hang around with astronauts is always kind of fun. But I think the biggest moment for me came when I was on vacation up in Victoria, Canada, and went to see it in a theater with people who had nothing to do with it. Yeah, we saw it, you know, not cast and crew, but, you know, you and I saw it, and, you know, but to be there when the only person there that had anything to do with it was everybody else was just the audience, and then you just kind of walk out and listen to what they say. That's when you feel like, you know what, it was a good movie. That nobody ever goes to a cast and crew screening and doesn't like the film. It's, you got to go wait and see what people who don't have a vested interest in it feel. And that one was pretty good. And that particular day was tons of kids, tons of preschool and a little bit of high school. And I thought this was an important message to get to the right people. And I wasn't even in my own country. So yeah, that one really made me feel pretty good about it. So
I did an opening of the film in Fort Lauderdale at their IMAX theater. And it was a middle of the morning. So it was packed with school kids. And there is a scene in the film where Terry Virts is running on the treadmill. And I don't know what it was about the music, but it was like Pavlovian for this whole three rows of kids. When they heard that music, they all jumped up and started dancing around with Terry while he's running on the treadmill in space. And all I could figure out was maybe that was what they did in school every day for their exercises, is they heard this song and, okay, got to exercise. Here we go.
Makes you wonder why they connect. You know, it's, I do remember with the audience, people reacting to things that I'd never reacted to. People either laughing at something or that apparently we never thought was funny, you know, but they still enjoyed it. So, and then there would be always these big vista shots that you could just kind of feel the pressure in the room change because people were taking in an image that should be impossible to get, you know, just looking back at the Earth. So.
Well, those were a big challenge for us, getting those shots of the Earth. And we approached it from a totally different standpoint. As you know, we shot 5K still images of the Earth and converted them to motion picture, which we did that because the 5K, the 1DC still images were closer to the aspect ratio of IMAX. It was a 5K image, 16-bit color, uncompressed raw images, so we were able to do a lot of manipulation with them and make them improve them. We shoot at about 4 frames per second sequential. Camera had to be locked off in the space station, and the Earth just went by at 4 frames a second. And then we took some of the digital magic that IMAX has developed over the years and created the other 20 frames per second to convert into smooth motion, 24 frame per second IMAX. And it impressed Graham Ferguson enough to say that was as good as the IMAX film we shot from space earlier. So I was kind of proud of that. It didn't work with every scene. If you had lightning, you know, in the scene, it kind of turned it into this amorphous glob of light and goo from Ghostbusters or something. I don't know why it wouldn't work, but it would have really intrigued the ET people out there to see us, these images of this whoop coming up out of
the... Let's not start any conspiracies.
Yeah.
So, all right. We're kind of running down here on the clock, so let's bid adieu. But thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Tim. Yeah, my pleasure.
We've been at this for about an hour.
Wow. Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, it's good to see you, actually. Really good to see you. So it's 2020. Hopefully I'll see you on the other side of that. But if not, we'll talk and stay safe. For listeners, just hang on for a minute and we'll be right back. That'll wrap up today's show, and I'd like to thank James Niehaus for being so generous with his time. And of course, you, the listener. I hope you'll come back again. We can't forget our premier sponsor, Film Tools, in the heart of Burbank and online at filmtools.com. Everything you need to keep your productions up and running. We'll talk to you next time.